when you're ready.
Okay, so, oh, would they really say that? Okay, that's what I was
saying. Yeah, that's a great point. They're going to make that point to the risk of your time.
Test, test. Joint Committee on Economic Development and Global Engagement Oversight, April 5th, 2018, 1 o'clock, room 643. End of test. All right, if I can get everybody settled, we'll try to get started. Senator Gunn, he showed up, so we'll go ahead and start now. Welcome to the Joint Committee on Economic Development and Global Engagement Oversight. And first, I'd like to recognize our Sergeant at Arms, Terry Barnhart, Linda Matthews on the Senate side, and Bill Bass, William Moore, and Jim Morin on the House side. All right, my co-chairs, any comments before we get started?
Thank you all for coming, and we've had a lot of very good conversation and some meetings in the weeds details trying to figure this stuff out. And I think this time we're trying to get an on-the-ground approach from people who are out in the field and doing this stuff. We've had a lot of confusion about our different organizations and how they work together. This is a very collaborative, very organic. Economic development touches everything, so it's hard to do a little flow chart that we might like and line everything up. So we're going to try to put it together from the ground. So I appreciate all of our speakers coming and hope you have and get a lot out of this agenda.
Representative Ross? Okay. All right, first thing we need to do is approve the minutes from our last meeting. You should have got those electronically. So I'm looking for a motion. Have a motion from Senator McKissick. All in favor, say aye. Any opposed? Okay. All right, we'll start with our presentations. First, Chris, we got you first again. Appreciate you coming back. Chris Chung is going to give the EDPNC annual report. He's the chief executive officer for the partnership. Chris, thanks for being here.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you again for having me back. It's a pleasure to be here again after last month. I have a lot to get through, so I will try to be as quick as possible and also leave some time for questions. But again, I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee as always. Before I get going, I'm not the only representative from the Economic Development Partnership in North Carolina here. As always, I just want to point out we've got a number of our volunteer appointed board members who are with me today. Gene McLaurin and Tom Looney are governor's appointees. Mark Zimmerman is a House appointee, and Sheila Knight is a Senate appointee. So part of that 17-member board of directors that the legislature appoints 8 seats out of between the House and the Senate. So a few things that I want to get through today. Basically, to give you a quick update on some of the criteria that matter to companies that we are working on trying to recruit to North Carolina, as well as helping them to expand here, I'd shared with you some information last month that was just updated that I think would be valuable for all of you, because I know a frequent question I receive from members of this committee are, what are the issues that companies think about when they're deciding where to locate for new investments? So I'll share that really quickly. Was also asked to touch very briefly on our performance in 2017. We just published our annual report, which we've shared with a few of the members of the legislature, but today we'll give everybody copies here as well. Talk quickly about what we need resource-wise to hopefully generate even more results on behalf of the state. And then one other thing I was asked to do that I didn't have time for last month was just to do a quick compare and contrast between our flagship incentive program in North Carolina versus a couple of the other states where I have spent part of my economic development career, Ohio and Missouri, just so you all can see, for example, how do these different states' main incentive programs compare with one another in terms of how they try to incentivize job creation and investment. So first things first, what matters to businesses? Let me get this out of the way here. You all should have in the packet that was provided to you by Catherine an updated list of something called the Area Development Corporate Survey. You have the full-length version, which includes this chart, but it's probably about a 15-page document. This is a publication that caters to corporate real exec real estate executives and site selectors every month. One of the big things they do every year is they go out there and they survey corporate executives and business owners and say, okay, put yourself in the situation of needing to expand or relocate. What are the issues that are most important to you when you make that decision about where to go? You'll see here on the presentation in front of you, but also in the packets that you have, a list of the most recent survey results from 2017, just released last month. This is really valuable information, not just because you all are making policy that determines how competitive we are to recruit and expand industry, but many of the communities that you represent are also trying to figure out what can they improve on to increase their odds of successfully growing jobs and investment. And I can't think of a better source than this annual list, because this comes directly from the very target audience itself. The companies we're trying to attract, the companies we're trying to convince to expand, all of that is spelled out in this annual survey, showing them what matters most. I put that up here in terms of the top 10. The ones that are highlighted in red, frankly speaking, those are the ones that policy can truly impact. It's hard for policy to affect things like quality of life. It's hard for you to affect location and proximity to markets. You can affect things like highway accessibility, availability of skilled labor, tax exemptions, obviously the corporate tax rate, incentives, available land, available buildings. We have a lot of great communities that would have good workforce, good educational institutions to offer, good location, close to highways. They lack product. They don't have a building that a company can move into. They don't have land that a company can build on. This is one of the biggest stumbling blocks that we see across North Carolina. Communities that want to compete to recruit new industry, they simply don't have an available product to put in front of that company that's looking at where to locate. But hopefully this updated list gives you all a lot of that information straight from the mouths of companies about what matters most to them. So I did want to share that. You have the full packet in front of you, as well as obviously part of the presentation. So that's item one. Item two, how did we do in 2017? Like I said, we just released our annual report. I'm actually going to go ahead and distribute them right now. Sorry, one second. I have extras in case anyone needs one later on, but I won't go through all of this in detail. It covers the body of our work as an economic development organization last year. Just as a reminder, you all know me, I don't miss an opportunity to remind folks of what we were created to do close to 4 years ago. Business recruitment is probably what we're best known for, but again, not the only way economic development happens in North Carolina. We're also responsible for tourism promotion, international trade, the support of existing companies and their growth plans, as well as counseling individuals who are looking to start new businesses somewhere here in North Carolina. So all five of those functions that the EDPNC was created to address, those are all covered in terms of how we did in 2017. I'll go through that really quickly. Again, business recruitment, existing industry, you all know by now what those things are that we are trying to accomplish on behalf of the state. How do we measure success? Let me just go through each of these because it's important for you to understand how our board, how our investors, and how you should be holding us accountable for whether or not we have had a successful or productive year. When it comes to business recruitment, we look at a few key metrics. First off, of course, is how many recruitment and expansion wins have we been part of helping produce here in North Carolina? Also, just as importantly, how many of those wins are happening in our Tier 1 and Tier 2 counties? How many jobs are announced as a result of those recruitment and expansion wins? And how much capital investment is coming about as a result of those recruitment and expansion wins? And all of our results in each of these metrics are spelled out in detail for you in the annual report that I've provided. I'll go through a few highlights. You also have in front of you on the presentation how we did in 2016 in that same category of performance. You look at number of projects won, successfully competed for, whether they're recruitment or expansion projects. We went from about 139 deals in 16 to 150 deals in 2017. In both years, we've eclipsed 90 wins for recruitment and expansion in Tier 1 and Tier 2 counties. That's a very important metric that matters a lot to our board of directors, also matters, I suspect, to a lot of you and the areas that you represent. The number of jobs coming about from those recruitment expansion wins went from just under 15,000 in 2016 to close to 20,000 in 2017. A few of the other statistics, going from $3.84 billion in new capital investment from those recruitment expansion wins last year to more than $4 billion this year. When it comes to how we measure success in our existing industry support efforts, and again, it's great for us to recruit new companies here, but let's not forget how valuable it is to keep helping the companies that are already here in North Carolina keep growing and keep expanding. That itself is going to contribute a lot to our job creation in the state. Our metrics here are the number of projects that our existing industry team works on. These are the folks who are based in each of the 8 prosperity zones all across North Carolina. They work every day with our local partners like the Charlotte Chamber, like the Wilson Economic Development Council that you'll hear from today, working with those local partners to call on existing employers and figuring out how we can help some of those companies keep expanding here in North Carolina. The ultimate metrics we look at are how many expansion projects that team competes for, how many they win in Tier 1 and Tier 2 areas, and then, of course, the jobs and the investment from those wins. Not every company we work with ends up doing an expansion, but we also want to make sure we're measuring how many of them we support by connecting with resources that may help them one day down the road when they are ready to make an expansion. So we also look at a metric called how many existing businesses we're supporting through that outreach service. So, in 2016, across pretty much every measure for our existing industry team, we saw a significant increase, whether you're talking number of expansion projects we won, whether you're talking jobs resulting from these expansions, even if you're talking about the number of companies that we support, all of our performance in 2017 significantly higher than where we finished 2016. I say all this to say there's still room to improve, but I think things are moving in the right direction based on the results we're posting on behalf of the state. International trade, export assistance. This is all about helping our existing manufacturers get into new markets around the world, find new customers internationally, sell more of their products, and bring that revenue back home to North Carolina where they can invest it in growing their companies here in the state. We look at two metrics in this division. How many North Carolina manufacturers did we help figure out whether, where, and how to get into new markets overseas? And then we follow up with all of them. We ask them to complete a voluntary survey to say, based on the assistance you received, how much in new export sales would you attribute to that assistance over the past year? It's completely voluntary. Not every company will share those results with us because if they think we're not going to keep that data confidential, if they think it'll end up in the wrong hands, they just don't send us a response. So we only have what they respond with to base it on, but that is what we can measure based on that effort. In 2016, we assisted about the same number of companies as we did in 2017. The nice thing we saw here was a significant increase in those voluntarily reported sales back to us from the companies we assisted with exports. $830 million in reported revenues back to us last year, $890 million in 2017. Why is that important? That's $890 million in new sales that our North Carolina companies are making that's coming by and large back here to North Carolina. That's $890 in new revenue that these companies will hopefully invest in growing their footprint in North Carolina. We've been talking lately with the North Carolina Chamber about how do we get the word out about our export assistance services to many of the companies that we simply just don't have the bandwidth to reach today. We think the Chamber can be a great partner for us in spreading the word. This is low-hanging fruit. If we can help companies figure out how to successfully go overseas, that money that they make as a result, that can power a lot of job creation expansion without all the effort it takes to go out there and recruit a new company in from the outside. So this is a certainly an important area for us. Small business startup assistance, this is the 1-800 number that we staff. 4 people take thousands of calls a year from individuals in all 100 counties of the state who are trying to figure out what they need to do to set up a new business here in North Carolina. Could be a landscaping business, could be home health care, they could be starting their own consulting firm. It doesn't really matter. They just need to understand, what do I need to do from a tax, HR, and legal perspective to get my business up and going in North Carolina? Our folks walk them through that steps, through those steps. Last year, 22,000 calls fielded by this team of four individuals. That's up from 20,000 in 2016. Again, we haven't received a penny more, but we are getting more cases processed on behalf of the state. We're not just sitting for the phone to ring, though. One of the things we did last year that you'll see up here is we took it upon ourselves to go proactively across the state, especially into more rural areas where we hadn't seen a lot of calls from in the past, and go out there and do seminars that are aimed at individuals who are looking at starting up a business and just walking them through what those steps are that they have to take to get that done. And that has hopefully driven even more activity by individuals looking to open a new business somewhere in our state. Lastly, tourism. It's a huge thing for many of the districts that you represent, and it is economic development in a lot of our state. The mountains, the coast especially, depend greatly on tourism to power their economic development and job creation. We are responsible on behalf of the state, the Commerce Department, in making the case to leisure visitors to come here to North Carolina to spend their time vacationing and spending their money at our retail and hotel establishments. Our metrics, we look at one big one in tourism. It's what is the annual visitor spending in North Carolina? $22.9 billion was the figure in 2016. We are probably less than 2 weeks away from getting that number for 2017. A lot of the indicators say that we are likely to pass where we were in 2016. Right now, it's just a question of how much do we beat our 2016 performance. That's a critical one. And as you all know, or as you all hopefully know, tourism supports about 213,000 jobs all across North Carolina. For every $105,000 of new visitor spending that we get to happen in North Carolina, that supports one job somewhere in the state. It could be part of a job here, part of a job there. But every 105,000 of visitor spending that we successfully get to North Carolina, that's going to support a job somewhere in our tourism economy. Okay, so those are our results from 2017, halfway there. What do we need to be more successful? Like I said last month, it always helps when our policymakers understand that economic development is more than just business recruitment. Business recruitment is sexy. Everyone wants to be at that ribbon cutting and groundbreaking that welcomes a new company to an area, but it is very competitive. It is hard to win business recruitment deals because every other state is also going after that same deal. There are a lot of other ways economic development can happen. I know you're going to hear from Patrick Woody from the Rural Center talking about the importance of taking care of our existing companies. A lot of that organic growth, if we can help companies accelerate their expansion plans and add jobs now and make investment now, that's just as good as recruiting a new company in from the outside. And frankly, it's a little bit easier because you've got the power of incumbency. When a company is in here, they've already got a little bit of incentive to stay and grow here. That's not always the case. I think Jennifer Lance will tell you she's done a lot of work to convince Bridgestone Tire, for example, to keep investing in the Wilson operations. Bridgestone has a lot of facilities around the world. They don't have to choose Wilson. She's got to make the case, and she's got to have the tools to make the case to Bridgestone to stay. But you have a lot of other companies that are here, and they may be probably a little easier to convince to keep growing here rather than companies we're trying to recruit where we're fighting with everybody to get them here. Tourism, international trade, all additional ways for economic development to happen. What do we need? Resources. I think, I know this is not an appropriations committee, but here's the reality. When this organization was formed 3.5 years ago, the same five functions that had been done when this was all housed within the public sector were receiving about $19 million in recurring core funding in state appropriations. We are down about $1.8 million in core recurring funding today, but I think our results are at or even above in many cases where we were 4 years ago. We have squeezed a lot of efficiencies in getting better at producing the results that you all demand of us, but at some point that that math doesn't work out. And so all we hope for is that there's some consideration that if these results are the kind that you want to see, it does take some amount of resources to keep ensuring we can get these same results and even more results down the road. Unfortunately, we don't have the ability to prioritize and say we're going to do less tourism and more international trade, or we're going to stop doing recruitment and do all small business startup. We are legislative required to do all five of these things as the EDPNC. So we can't shift resources around. We have to do all five of these. And even if we had the choice, we would still do all five because all five are important to economic development in North Carolina. But like I said, I hope after 3.5 years, we've demonstrated that this model works well and that we're getting results. We'd only ask that as you talk to your colleagues who are in charge of appropriations, the resource question is going to become an issue at some point down the road. Lastly, an opportunity to inform policy decisions. We know you guys are weighing a lot of important things that have an ability or impact on our success. We appreciate the chance to be here on days like today to help you reach some of those decisions on your policy. Last thing I'll do that I didn't have time for last month, I was just asked to touch on today, and then I will be done, is just comparing how our incentives stack up. I'm not an incentives expert on all 50 states. I can speak, however, to a couple of states that we do compete with from time to time, states where I have spent part of my 20-plus years in economic development, Ohio and Missouri. I'm going to talk about their two flagship programs because I want to essentially show you how these compare, for example, to our state's JDIG program, which is our flagship incentive that we talk about the most when we're trying to attract companies here. In Ohio, they have a flagship program called the Job Creation Tax Credit, and in Missouri, it's called Missouri Works. Real quickly, and I won't get too much into the weeds, the Ohio Job Creation Tax Credit essentially looks a lot like the JDIG. They look at how a company who's going to create new jobs, they can be new to the state or they can be expanding, but they look at how much payroll that company is going to be generating with their job creation. And they essentially give a percentage of that annual payroll back to the company as a refundable tax credit. So they still have tax credits in Ohio. This one is structured as a refundable tax credit that rewards companies creating new jobs somewhere in the state. For them, if you create as few as 10 new jobs, you can qualify for this program. So small projects, big projects, it doesn't matter. The state has the ability to incentivize all of those types of deals anywhere in between. You do have to create at least 660,000 in new annual payroll. So, of course, they're trying to aim for a higher type of job. For them, the job pay requirement is at least 150% of the federal minimum wage, which I think is probably, that would put you at about 10, 50, 11 bucks an hour right now. They do not have a limit to the number of tax credits that they can issue through this program. So they can do 1,000 deals a year or they can do 10 deals a year. It doesn't matter. They recognize that they are giving back a portion of the economic tax benefit that a company creates when they create new jobs, but they recognize the house is always going to keep some part of the money. And for them, the house will keep as much money as they can because they'll do as many deals as they can in any given year. So that's one important program that I wanted to highlight. Missouri, where I spent 7 years, their flagship program is called Missouri Works. Very similar again. They look at a company who's creating new jobs in the state. They could be there for a long time. They could be new to the state. They basically look at that new payroll, so number of jobs times wages, and they give a percentage of the value of that payroll back to the company for a certain number of years. So again, very similar to the mechanics of a JDIG. For Missouri, you can create as few as 2 jobs to qualify, especially in rural areas. They have a special designation where 2 jobs in rural project areas would qualify for the program. That's the one I talk about here, special category for rural projects. For Missouri, you've got to pay at least 90% of the county's average wage to enter into this program. The way they give this benefit back to you as the employer, let's say you're creating 100 jobs at $100,000 per year. I think if my math is right, that works out to $10 million in new annual payroll that's being produced. So Missouri would give you, let's say, 5% of that payroll back to you as a company. So 5% times 10 million is 500,000. So you get $500,000 in benefit every year for a five-year standard term. That's not negotiated. That's the statutory term for the program. You get your benefit as an employer through a combination of retaining the withholdings for the jobs that you're creating. So you can retain as much as 100% of those withholdings for those new jobs. And then any difference between that and what you're entitled to as your benefit goes to you in the form of a refundable tax credit. So they layer these benefits to get to that percentage of the payroll that they're rewarding to the company in exchange for those jobs. The annual limit on refundable tax credits, there's no limit on how much in withholdings retention a company can do. There is a limit on those refundable tax credits that make up part of the benefit of this program. The annual limit in Missouri for this program is $116 million. So, again, a different example, but a state that I would say we will compete with from time to time, and those flagship incentives are important to remember. So I've just compared them side by side with what the JDIG program looks like today. Job creation, you can go as low as 2 in Missouri, 10 in Ohio. Our statutes for JDIG say anywhere from 10 to 50, although for the past decade plus, the policy has been a little bit different. The threshold has actually probably been a little bit higher in practice. So what the statute says is very different than what we maybe have seen in reality for the past decade. How does the incentive go out to awardees? Well, JDIG, it's an annual grant that goes out each year for up to 12 years. In Ohio, it's that annual refundable tax credit that goes out to the company each year for up to 10 years. And in Missouri, they give you that combination of withholdings retention and refundable tax credits over 5 or 6 years. The interesting thing in Missouri, if you are a company that's been there for longer than 10 years, you get an extra year of benefit to this program. So it's essentially rewarding companies who have been invested in that state for a longer period of time. It's actually a fairly clever way to reward long-standing companies that have been in the state for a while. Annual cap on the program. We know JDIG is $20 million exclusive of high yield. You look at the Ohio Job Creation Tax Credit, they have no limit there. They can do as many deals as they want because they know that they're always going to keep some portion of that new revenue. And then Missouri, no limit on those withholding retentions, but they do cap the tax credits that go out through this program, refundable tax credits, at $116 million a year. Special treatment of counties. We've got those three tiers in North Carolina. In Ohio, they have what they call priority investment areas where the rewards can be a little bit higher if you locate there. And then in Missouri, basically, if you go in a non-urban county, you are eligible for a higher percentage of awards. They don't have tiers, but they do say urban versus non-urban, and the rewards are different there. And then, like I said, special benefit for companies that have quote-unquote seniority from having been in the state for a long time. Of these three states anyway, Missouri is the one that offers that extra year of financial benefit for the program if you've been there for at least 10 years or longer. So I realize that was a lot of detail to get into. I'm exhausted. I'm sure you are too. But I wanted to showcase just a couple examples of what we see across the country. Again, these are states that will come into our competitive sphere from time to time. I have some knowledge having worked in those states, and I thought it might be beneficial as you are weighing some potential changes to JDIG to see at least a couple examples of where some other states are with their flagship incentives. So with that, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, thank you for your time, and I'll happily answer any questions from the committee.
Thank you, Chris. I'm going to open it up to a couple questions. I'm going to get us out of here by 3 o'clock today, so I'm going to open up maybe a couple questions. Senator Wade.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wondered if you're working with the governor in any way on the opportunity zones, and if you can bring us up to date on that, and what the criteria is going to be, and we really haven't heard anything about it other than one of the cities in my district had already turned some information in on census tracts, which I wasn't even aware of. We were, you know, out requesting that information. Do you know anything at all about it?
I'm familiar with Napoleon Wallace, the deputy secretary, has been tasked with identifying a potential list of those. And you can imagine he's been inundated with requests. I think last time I saw him, he'd received 230-some requests, each containing 5 or 6 census tracts that could be eligible. I think we can only, as a state, I think only submit something like 300 census tracts for opportunity zone designation. So it's going to be, it's balancing a lot of that. So we're not involved in the process, but we do know who's.
Senator Wade, we're going to talk about it in May as well. So we'll get more information on that coming up. Okay. Representative Goodman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chris. Great presentation. Looking at our JDIG program, what would you do to make it a better and a more effective program that we don't do now?
I mean, as you all heard me say on previous occasions, I think the cap forces some artificial choices that may not bode well for either urban or rural areas. I mean, we want all of North Carolina to win, and when you cap a program, you are forcing a false choice, because the way JDIG, the way these other states' programs work, is they recognize that 50% of something is a lot better than 100% of nothing, which is what you get if you lose a deal. So if you win a deal, you're willing to forsake some of the new revenue you get as a result, because the house always keeps some portion, right? Is it 50%? Is it 75%? Kind of depends on the project. If the house always gets to keep some, why limit the house's ability to do more deals where they're just going to keep more of those subsequent transactions? I mean, there's a reasonable criticism, which I know people have said, which is, well, do these companies need these incentives? Wouldn't they have come here anyway? That's a very legitimate question. The reality is that's impossible to test. We can't strap our clients to a polygraph machine. That probably wouldn't be very good customer service. So if we can't address that issue, then we have to look at, well, is the state making net revenue as a result of incentivizing these deals? And as you can see, some of these other states, they have factored that into their calculus. That and the thresholds, the job creation thresholds. You've seen you can do 2 jobs, 10 jobs in some of these other programs. The statute allows it, but can we actually do that in practice with JDIG? We can't lobby, but you're asking a question. I mean, those are some things that could help improve utilization of the program in a broader part of the state.
Senator Edwards.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for being here. Also, I just wanted to say real quick, I know that you took some folks for a getaway to the mountains not long ago and left some money behind, and I appreciate you doing that for us. I'm anxious to hear how your visit went. Two questions. On your performance metric, you refer to the number of wins in Tier 1 and 2 counties.
Right.
How many of these jobs that are on here are attributed to those 47 and 60 wins?
I'll be happy to follow up. I can get that to Catherine. I don't have that number off the top of my head. I will say that a lot of the expansion projects in Tier 1, Tier 2 tend to be a little bit smaller because of the size of the company. So I would say it's probably not an equal split proportionately, but I can get the specific number to you afterwards, Senator.
Thank you. I'd appreciate that. One more question. You mentioned appropriations and resources a while ago. My question to you would be, if this were an appropriations committee and we told you you had one wish, tell us the first thing that you would fund that you don't have now.
More foreign direct investment. Yes, because that has been you all heard me say it last month, that has been a dominant theme of what we've seen on the business recruitment side. We've gone from 1 out of every 4 projects involving a foreign company to 1 out of every 3 the past year. The great thing about foreign direct investment projects, overwhelmingly, they tend to be more manufacturing focused. They tend to look more at least non-urban, sometimes often rural areas based on the needs of that manufacturing company. So this is about creating additional opportunities for rural North Carolina communities to compete for inbound investment. Having an office in India, we've talked about that for a long time. We see a lot of projects. Senator Gunn, Representative Martin, they have helped personally pitch their communities for companies from India that have looked in North Carolina. We've seen deals from that part of the world. We don't have anyone in that market trying to shake the trees and find even more deals. Imagine what we could accomplish if we did have that kind of resource. The second part B, we don't have recurring dollars to go out there and promote the state for business. We have a lot, and we're appreciative for what we get on the tourism side. We really, until the past couple of years, haven't received any dollars to go promote the state for business to a business community. We've received some non-recurring funding, but as you all know, it's really hard to plan anything long-term if that funding is only year-to-day. You all have focused a lot on making us a more competitive business climate. That's great. We have a good product. How are we going to get that message out to the product, i.e. the business community? We haven't had much money in the past to address that. That would be another thing that would help us too.
All right. Representative Conrad.
Thank you. Hopefully just a quick question. On that survey, corporate tax rate and state and local incentives are right there together, number 8 and 9. When you were comparing North Carolina to Ohio and Missouri. I was wondering how our corporate tax rate compares, because we've had a long time discussion here of our other measures that we're doing, such as lowering our tax rate, tax reform, mitigating the importance of incentives. And it looks like those two states rely on them a little bit more. So I was just curious.
Great question. Missouri, if I can recall, and it's amazing how much you shove out of your brain to make room for new stuff. I think they're sitting around 5% for corporate income tax rate. Ohio actually did away with corporate income tax more than 10 years ago, and they moved to what's called a commercial activities tax. It's similar to a gross receipts. So it taxes revenue versus profits, but of course at a much, much, much lower percentage because of revenue versus profit. I know this is not a tax conversation. I had to help sell that reform when I was there 13 years ago, but I can go into much more detail offline about that. But they don't have a corporate income tax in the traditional sense.
All right. Last question, Representative Bodie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you maybe clarify what our policy is in this particular situation? Is if a company is coming into North Carolina, but it has direct competition already in North Carolina, do we have a policy of trying to address that situation? And I guess in relation to, it may create new jobs, but the new jobs it created could be at the expense of already existing jobs.
Yeah, we try to understand, and keep in mind, we work very closely with the secretary and the team at Commerce. We sit down every week and review the list of active expansion and recruitment deals that we're competing for, and rest assured, the secretary wants us to come prepared to that discussion, knowing everything we can about that project and how it may have that sort of impact somewhere else in the state. Yeah, no state wants to induce companies just picking up and moving jobs from one part of the state to another, and nobody wins in that. So I can assure you that there are safeguards in place when we're looking at how those incentives are used to prevent that same exact situation that you're talking about.
All right.
Chris, I appreciate it. Good information. I'm sure there's a lot of other questions the members would like to get at you. I think Senator McKissick may have one that he will get with you maybe later on. I'm trying to move this, Senator McKissick, if I could. But, Chris, if you would get with Senator McKissick on his questioning. And but appreciate you being here today, okay? Next I have from the North Carolina Chamber, Vice President of Governmental Affairs, Gary Salamino. Gary, thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for giving us an opportunity to come up and talk a little bit about today what our members are seeing, what the business community is seeing about North Carolina and how we're doing with it. I'm going to cover a couple things, who we are, kind of how we set our agenda, and then how we measure ourselves. And we have a new publication that I'm going to share with you that will be included in the minutes. There'll be a link to it. Share some top-level numbers about how North Carolina economy is looking. And we preface all of our remarks and all of our strategy around four pillars for a secure North Carolina. In each of those pillars, I'm going to have some recommendations about things that the General Assembly could consider going forward in order to enhance our competitiveness even a little bit more with it. So in 2012, we established a Vision 2030, a plan for a secure North Carolina's future, which is a 15-year guide of how we're going to look at it, the business community is going to look at helping to get North Carolina to be competitive and maintain its competitive. There's four pillars there: education and talent supply, business climate, infrastructure and growth, and entrepreneurship and innovation. And folks ask us a lot, they say, well, out of those four pillars for economic growth, which is the most important? And the answer to that question is always all of them. We have to be able to make sure that all of those are working together, working in concert, because it's no one thing that drives economic competitiveness for the state and in the long term. It's all of those four working together. We survey our members a lot, and whether it's through our committees, whether it's through our board, all different types of ways that we get access. Right now, we are seeing the most, I think 90%, depending on how we look at it, of folks that we have talked to are feeling really, really good about North Carolina and where they are and where their investments are. So satisfaction from our members, about 35,000 members, is pretty high with it. Not everybody, you know, feels the same way, but on average, and these are some of the highest numbers we've seen since I've been at the chamber, people are feeling really good. I'll give you some statistics, and then I'll point to some specific things, and then I would really like to hear from you all about what you're feeling, what you're seeing, and answer any questions about the chamber. So thanks to the work over the last few years, business taxes went from 44th to 11th, distinct competitive advantage for North Carolina. Of all the states that have a corporate income tax right now, North Carolina's is the lowest with it. Extremely competitive in that position. The UI system, the solvency that was restored to that, giving predictability back to businesses in terms of what they're going to pay into that system for each job, has really helped a lot. We can't thank you enough for that, because it has allowed folks to plan and grow and to add jobs, knowing what that tax is going to be, and knowing going forward that should things get bad again, and they will, that there are good stopgap measures in place to make sure that we don't get in a jam with the federal government that we did before. Tort reform and tort legislation moved us from 30th or so down to 7th in the country. We've since dropped, and there's a couple of reasons for that, but predictability in our tort and our legal system has greatly enhanced North Carolina's competitiveness. Workers' comp rates, because of the reforms in 2011 and because of the way the rates have been set, 3 years in a row now, workers' comp rates have been going down again, giving businesses predictability and how much it costs to add a job. And the infrastructure reforms that happened a few years ago, critically important. We'll talk a little bit more about those going forward, but the commitment of this General Assembly to make investments in infrastructure that hadn't happened since 1989. Fundamental reforms in the funding and how infrastructure was funded have had a significant impact. In addition to those indicators, we've improved our unemployment rate, our job growth, and our wage growth. At the height of the Great Recession, we saw record high unemployment rates, north of 10%. Right now, we're sitting at 4.5% unemployment rate. Since 2014, we've added nearly 80,000 jobs a year. And I'll talk about the goal of the progress report and the goal for us. But by 2030, for North Carolina to meet its needs and to remain competitive, we got to add 1 million jobs into the state of North Carolina. We added 80,000 jobs. We're ahead of pace for achieving that million job goal in 2030 by 28% going into today. And North Carolina is a leading state in wage growth, ranking 9th in the nation with a 3.8% increase in earnings over that same time period. Things are working. Things are working together. The pillars that we had are working with each other. We're seeing tangible evidence of that, but there's more to do. There's always more to do. The greatest risk that our members see is complacency. Things are good. People begin to not look at what needs to be done to improve and to maintain a sustainable competitive advantage for our state. So this is going to be online. I have a few copies of it here. I'm going to talk about the four overarching goals and give some data, and then go into specifically what I think we can do. We have a progress assessment report that's available on our foundation website. And it looks at all four pillars. What are the key metrics in all those four pillars to see if we're making progress toward them, if we're stagnant, or if we're going backwards on it? So let me go through the top four as an overview, then be happy to talk about others as we go along. First one is employment growth. We talked about the goals between 2016 and 20 to add 310,000 jobs. To 2025, 332,000 new jobs, and between 2025 and 2030, 358,000 jobs. That's an average of 79,000 jobs a year. We're outpacing that. So far, so good. We're going to hit that million-dollar mark if we continue to be vigilant and continue to do the kinds of things that we have been doing in concert with each other. Earnings growth is up too. The goal was 2014 to 2016 to be at $15 billion. The results so far from 2014 to 2016 are $18.8 billion in earnings gain, 25% above the goal for this period of time in order to reach the 2030 goals. Consumer spending. The vision was to grow consumer spending by $4.1 billion annually. Right now, the results are between 2014 and 2016. We're at $26.7 billion in consumer spending, a 325% growth rate compared to the plan. And last is bank deposits. Raise bank deposits in North Carolina banks by $652 million annually. The results between 2014 and 2016 were at $7.4 billion gain, multiple times greater than the goal. So the reforms over the years, within those four pillars, in the education and talent supply, competitive business climate, infrastructure and growth, and the entrepreneurship and innovation policies that have been are working. There's more to do, and I'll talk about those in a couple of seconds. All in all, things are business is positive. Business sees a great future. They're planning for that next recession right now with it, as you all hear with your rainy day fund. Well, businesses are doing the same kind of thing. So all in all, we're in a good spot. So what are the things? So one of the questions that we were asked to come up with, what are some of the things that the General Assembly policies, the General Assembly should look at going forward? Number one, education and talent supply. We have a membership development group that is out in the field every day, all day. They average 75 new company interactions a month, ranging from tech companies to manufacturing companies. As an aside, about 60% of our members are manufacturing companies, both in the collar counties and the non-urban areas. Number one issue, barring none, is talent. They have opportunities to invest. They have the jobs, and we have the people. But the people and the skills that the folks have and the jobs are not matching up. We have a skills gap, it's been called. We also have a misalignment in terms of we don't have a statewide vision for what our education systems from pre-K, K-12, community college, and university systems are doing to make sure that we have the skills and we have the processes and the systems in place in order to produce those million jobs in North Carolina. So what President Spellings is doing, we're encouraged by that. We know we're going to have a new community college president here shortly. We hope that the K-12 folks at the state board and DPI can begin to get sorted through some of the issues that they're facing. But the number one issue facing a state when we're so competitive among so many other markers right now is talent. Challenge there is we're probably the fifth net in-migration of talent in the country right now. So in our urban areas particularly, the talent's coming in with it. The non-urban areas are struggling because we have the gap in between what the skills are where the jobs are and the skills that the folks have. So a key piece for us in working with you is to begin to talk about going forward, how do we get that alignment better? How do we get the products, the young people, the talent that's coming out of our institutions aligned with the jobs of today and equally, if not more importantly, the jobs of the future? On a competitive business climate, we were doing really well. On our tort reforms and our legal climate, we slipped in the latest Harris poll that came out in 2017. It's the largest slip in the history of the poll. And our legal climate now is looked at, and this is a perception poll, so there has some limitations to it, but it's looked at as a volatile place with it. It has a lot to do with things that we've seen over the last couple of years. It has a lot to do with the litigation that's gone on between companies and between the government. To be candid, the litigation that's going on within state government now in a number of sources. So that level of uncertainty has caused the general counsels who participate in that survey to say, you know, we're not so sure. Certainty for a general counsel is a really important thing with it. So they're seeing some of that. So we've seen that slip. One of the ways that we can begin to look at that now is through a bill that came through the Senate that the House will hopefully consider this session is the transparency and the asbestos trust fund piece with it. That's important for a lot of companies that don't even produce products there. These trust funds are beginning to dry up, and the processes that are in place right now are not allowing people to get to the resources that those companies have put into those trust funds in a timely manner, because there's double and triple dipping sometimes that's happening in there. One of the things that the Harris poll pointed out is if we can get some transparency in that, and then North Carolina can demonstrate not only on that issue but on others that they understand the importance of balance and the importance of getting people that were harmed their money in a predictable way where the companies that put the money aside, that would send a good message that North Carolina will be back on track. The goal for the chamber is by the year 2020 to have us back in the top 10 with it, with that and some other initiatives that our legal institute will be putting forward. Entrepreneurship and innovation, thank you for what you've done on crowdfunding, the folks that were involved there. That was a nice message that was sent to our entrepreneur community. Probably 2.0 crowdfunding is something we need to think about for the long session now that we have some experience with it, again, with the appropriate consumer protections. Another thing is we have to look at how we get our intellectual property out of our university system. We have great university systems producing really good intellectual property. It's not clear and it's not always transparent how easy that gets out and how much we can get into the commercial market as quickly as possible. Other states are doing that better than us, and so we look forward to those discussions that with the university system and those institutions to create a more streamlined process of getting our intellectual property out. And lastly, but certainly not least, is continued focus on infrastructure investment. We made great strides a couple of years ago, and it's really, you can see no matter where you travel in the state, things are getting better. We're going to add these million people by the year 2030. We can't wait till they get here to make those investments in infrastructure. It's much cheaper, and it's much better to do that before they get here. So we're going to be encouraging folks, again, look at alternative funding models, alternative ways to expedite projects through the STI and to get more projects into the STI in an effort to get the infrastructure investments at road, rails, ports, both airports and water ports, to help us be competitive and be positioned for the future. So, again, I talked fast there, too, but I really would enjoy hearing from you or answering any questions, and, again, very much appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
Thanks, Gary. Questions for Gary? Senator Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gary, I appreciate your presentation. You made a comment that has bothered me for some time, and I haven't been able to figure out how to get it done, and that's the intellectual properties you're talking about, and that is at their university systems. What states have you looked at and that are making that happen, I guess, much better than we are?
Yeah. California and the Silicon Valley has a reputation for getting their intellectual property out quicker with fewer and fewer barriers to that. That they kind of the universities out there rely on, we're going to do the research, and then when the research is done, we're going to easily get that out into the marketplace, and then the money comes there, and the market decides which ones make it and which ones don't with it. And there's very few strings connected back to the universities there. So that's one place that's doing it well that we benchmark against. Texas is doing it well in similar regards. And to be honest with you, Massachusetts is doing it well with it. Those universities say the research is really important, and we're going to focus in on the intellectual property, getting the research done right. And then when the ideas are ready, we're going to let the market decide which ones make it and don't make it. So those are the three states we look at that are probably, you know, California, we're probably not going to compete with California, but Texas is a fair competitor, and so is Massachusetts to look at.
Other questions? All right. Good job, Gary.
Thank you.
Next we have, I'm sorry. Representative Moore, you got a question. I'm sorry. I missed you.
That's all right. Very quickly, Mr. Chairman. Gary, thank you for your presentation. I want to know if the chamber has any type of outreach, some type of mentorship for emerging businesses, MWB businesses, and want you kind of cede that to the local chambers, or is there something on the state level that you do in collaboration or to facilitate minority and women-owned businesses to become a part of the larger picture of business climate and through the chamber?
Yeah. Just two answers to that. First, you hit on it, Representative. We work with our local chamber federation, 85 local chambers, and the local business development, they're the experts. They're the folks on the ground there, and we take our lead from them on that. And if there's ways we can help, they'll let us know, and then we try to do that. And the minority-owned businesses and small businesses, we're actually going through a process right now in the chamber about getting a whole lot better at and understanding that and getting better at diversity and inclusion, both on our staff, within our membership, and within our events and how we're doing it. So that process is, we're smack dab in the middle of it now, and you'll be hearing more about that very shortly.
Okay. Thanks, Gary. Next, we have Bob Morgan, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Charlotte Chamber of Commerce. Welcome, Bob.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to be here to share Charlotte's perspective on economic development, it is a great opportunity. To start out, the Charlotte Chamber of Commerce is a 501c6 not-for-profit organization. We represent 2,700 businesses in the Charlotte marketplace. We do a lot of things, economic development first and foremost. We are the chief economic development recruitment agency for the city of Charlotte and for Mecklenburg County. What that looks like is that we have three full-time economic developers who market and recruit nationally and internationally. And we have two full-time researchers providing market intelligence on target and emerging industries, about which I'll talk more in just a second. The numbers are frankly impressive, if I do say so myself. We've seen since 2008, we've worked directly with 614 projects representing more than 5,600 jobs that have come to our marketplace. If you look just at 2017, we worked 167 projects. Of those, 44 were landed, representing 5,431 jobs. And I'll jump ahead in my presentation here and say that well over 70% of those we worked in partnership with the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina. So, Chris, we appreciate you and your team as the great partner that you are to us. We are also a public policy advocate. We have two full-time registered lobbyists on staff who are focused on promoting a pro-business, pro-Charlotte agenda at every level of government. And the Charlotte Chamber of Commerce, you know, some chambers have a role in economic development. Some don't. We do. Some chambers that are in economic development receive public funding. Some do, some don't. We don't. We happen to be 100% funded by our members. As we look at the industries and the types of jobs that we look to target, we recently conducted a pretty classic cluster analysis economic development strategic planning process in conjunction with the Charlotte Regional Partnership. And the clusters that we target include financial services. We remain the third largest banking center in the United States. Transportation and logistics. We are within a two-hour flight or 12-hour trucking distance to 53% of the U.S. population. Healthcare continues to be by far our largest employer and the fastest growing. Information technology, we are the fastest growing tech talent market from 2011 to 2016 with 77% growth. And advanced manufacturing, we're one of the nation's top producers of turbines and engine equipment, among other products that are manufactured in our region. Now, I will, at the risk of focusing on a negative, let's talk about IT for just a second. Would be less than honest if I didn't share with you that Charlotte, we were surprised and disappointed not to make Amazon's list of the 20 cities now competing for the HQ2 project. We have endorsed and will do everything that we can to support Raleigh and the Triangle's landing successfully of that project. But here's what we learned from that process that's relevant today. Amazon liked our market, strong pro-business environment, like our airport, like our investment in light rail. They liked the fact that our tech workforce is growing faster than most of the other markets that they're looking at. The base of that talent from which we begin is smaller than most of the markets that they are looking at. And that feeds back from our perspective into the need. We do not have the level of higher education in the Charlotte market that you see in the Triangle, that you see in Atlanta, St. Louis, Jacksonville, other places with which we compete. We've known that for 20 years, but the challenge of continuing to grow UNC Charlotte as a PhD granting institution and to help it grow and scale is work that continues as we go forward. We like to say in Charlotte that economic development is a team sport, and in fact it is. We work very closely with the city of Charlotte and Mecklenburg County as it relates to project management as well as local incentives. We work very closely with the North Carolina Department of Commerce, primarily as it relates to the incentives projects, JDIG primarily, that are so important to us. And I've mentioned already the work we do with the EDPNC. 25% of the projects that we work with are leads that came to us from the EDPNC, and of the jobs that were landed, again, 5,431 jobs in 2017, 72% of those, or 3,900, came from the EDPNC. Now, again, we worked 44 projects that landed. We'd like to address I think there's a perception, certainly locally, that everything we touch is qualifying for an incentive and seeking an incentive. In fact, that's not the case. We like to talk about in our business, most of what we work are the singles and doubles of economic development. We took 6 projects before the city and the county for incentives last year out of 44 that we landed. And what's important to know about that from a resource allocation perspective, that project that might be bringing in 20 jobs that doesn't require incentives probably requires as much or even more time as some of the larger projects. So that's just a reality of our business at the local level. When we ask the question, or I get asked the question quite often, why Charlotte? You begin with some basics. We have a cost of living that's 96% of the national average. We're not the cheapest market in the Southeast, but relative to markets in the Northeast and Midwest and West Coast, certainly attractive from a cost perspective. We have a growing workforce and population. We're a metropolitan population of 2.5 million people, one of the fastest growing populations in the country. That workforce are made up of people that know how to run businesses, they know how to make things. That workforce is increasingly young, and it's increasingly diverse. And the diversity of that workforce is an advantage for us for many of the companies that we are recruiting. We like to say the number one economic development asset in Charlotte by far is our airport, the 7th busiest airport in the world by takeoffs and landings. You can't overestimate the direct economic impact, but just the ability to connect to markets throughout North America and internationally with daily direct service. Certainly, there are policies that have come out of state government that are competitive advantages as well, and I would use this opportunity to thank the legislature for what you've done. Our tax rates, our corporate tax rates, are quite a competitive advantage. The work in regulatory reform, the work in reform of things like STI, the work of the North Carolina Turnpike Authority, very important to us, and educational institutions like our K-12 Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, Central Piedmont Community College, and I've already referenced UNC Charlotte, all of which are critical. As Gary just mentioned, the talent workforce crunch in an economy of 4% unemployment, the acquisition of talent is the number one issue for virtually any of our members of whatever industry or whatever size. I would also touch on the subject of incentives. We would stand before you today and tell you that we think that North Carolina, and in our case, the city of Charlotte and Mecklenburg County, have provided modest tools for incentives that have helped us to be successful. We would thank you for those. We would suggest that Charlotte, more often than not, much more often than not, it is rare that we're competing with other counties or other locations in North Carolina. In fact, our primary competitors you see here include places like Atlanta, Nashville, Austin, Tampa, New York, New Jersey. And we have the unique situation of sitting on the state line where South Carolina is fairly aggressive and is sometimes able to offer incentives beyond what we are able to. That becomes an issue. Take the hypothetical company that may be in Charlotte already that has 1,000 jobs and they want to add 500 new jobs. Let's say that those 500 new jobs qualify for our JDIG program. We can incent, Chris, those 500. If that company moves a few miles across the border, South Carolina will incent them for all 1,500 jobs. And so that's just a dynamic that sometimes South Carolina can bring those resources, additional resources to the table. But we still, we don't bellyache about that. We do pretty well competing against South Carolina when you look at the total package, which is very important. And yet, we would say that incentives are a very important piece of the overall package. We appreciate those that we have, and would be remiss not to use the opportunity to tell you that we would support an increase in the cap on JDIG or even an elimination altogether of that. I did not mention back on the target study, they don't fall under traditional industrial classifications, but we target corporate headquarters. Corporate headquarters of all types, and those competitive advantages that I mentioned are the same for corporate headquarters as they are for any of those other industrial clusters. And then building on what Chris said about foreign direct investment, We've got about 1,000 firms in the Charlotte region, foreign-owned firms. That number is growing. We're very busy. We have a developer on his way to Germany as we speak, another one who spends regular time in Asia. More of our business comes from Western Europe, Germany, the UK, France, than from anywhere else. Asia has been a story of success. 10 years ago, we had 5 Chinese companies in our market. Today, we have 48. We hired a young woman who's a native of Shanghai, speaks Mandarin, his native tongue, spends regular time with the Department of Commerce and the EDPNC in Asia, and we think that that kind of growth is going to continue. In concluding all of this, we just ask you to consider that while we are focused on the city of Charlotte and Mecklenburg County, that's our chief role. In fact, there are over 700,000 jobs in Mecklenburg County, and more than 1 in 4 of the people that hold those jobs live in the surrounding counties. That means we have 175,000 people who commute into Mecklenburg County every day. Now, I could sit here for another hour and talk about the transportation challenges that go with that. I know that's not our purpose, but 175,000 commuters into Mecklenburg County every day who take home $17.5 billion in wages to the rest of the region. And so we think that regional impact is important to understand as well. That's an overview of economic development from the perspective of the Charlotte Chamber of Commerce, and delighted to answer any questions that you might have.
Good report, Bob. Really good. And questions for Bob? Bob, you must have done a really good job. Let's see. Vice Chair Martin.
Thank you. Thank you for coming to spend time. And I had the privilege of meeting with Bob earlier in the year and just learning as we've been exploring all around the state the differences. Like we've talked about, there's a big difference. Our counties have different needs and different challenges and different skill sets. And this was very impressive to see the organization that's through the chamber, which I viewed was a unique setup, but I've learned it's not the only one set up that way, but it's different than a lot of our smaller county use of the chamber. And we will hear today some different roles. So we thank you for your expertise and your willingness to share that, and hopefully that helps all of North Carolina as we move forward.
Great. Thank you for the opportunity.
Any other questions for Bob? Anything? All right. Representative Brody.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question on transportation. When you had your map up there, we have the Highway 74 from Wilmington to Charlotte, and I happen to represent the two areas that bogged down that whole area, and of course one of them is trying to be relieved now, the Monroe Bypass. But how important, in comparison to some of the other projects, that, let's say, that Highway 73 coming down from Greensboro down to Rockingham, would that, to improve that Highway 74 to, in order to get from Wilmington to Charlotte without all those stoplights, et cetera?
Again, I could go an hour on that subject because it's very important. So we're very excited that later this year the Monroe Bypass will open, which will be a parallel alternative to Highway 74 through most of Union County, reducing the drive time from Charlotte to Wilmington by 25 minutes. Why does that matter? More of Charlotte's product comes in and out of the port of Charleston than any other. I know we don't like to hear that on the North Carolina side of the border, but yet we are also the largest customer to the Port of Wilmington. And it's important for you all to know that the work of the Port of North Carolina, I am a huge fan of Paul Rizzo, right? Did I get that name right? Koza Rizzo, our leader of the North Carolina ports, what he's doing there and the service that he has increased that corridor to Charlotte, they are growing their business significantly, and that's helpful. To take 25 minutes off the drive will be important for tourism in North Carolina. A lot of people in Charlotte and points west, simply it's easier to get to Charleston because of the bottleneck through Union County. This will help to alleviate that. For freight, trucks, same thing. I would challenge us to think of it, though, as more than the Wilmington to Charlotte corridor. It's really the opportunity, I think, is the Wilmington to Asheville Highway 74 corridor. When you look at things like the Shelby Bypass and the opportunity to connect all of the central and western parts
part of the state more closely to eastern North Carolina. Very important. I mentioned the work of the North Carolina Turnpike Authority. That will be the first greenfield toll project in our region in the modern era, and it'll be significant.
All right. Good job, Bob. We appreciate that report, okay?
Thank you very much.
All right. Next, we have Jennifer Lance, the Executive Director, and also the Wilson Economic Development of the Wilson Economic Development Council. So, Jennifer, please come.
Senator Brennan, I'm Representative Martin. Thank you so much for having me come today. Our basic mission at the Economic Development Council in Wilson is to raise the standard of living while providing enough tax dollars to support public services. I mean, that's essentially what we do. So we look at jobs, we look at investment, we look at the average salary, we look at what types of companies are coming, we look at the reputations of those companies and how they're going to help our community. And Wilson is kind of the classic have and have not. So you can look at working people, and the statistics are really strong. 10th highest average weekly wage in the state. And then you can look at those who are not working, and the statistics are terrible. Poverty rate of 22.3%. So looking at our better statistics, we're a tier 3. Looking at our worst statistics, we're a tier 1. And we're constantly working to try to change that. In Wilson, we have something that is very unique in North Carolina. We have tremendous leadership with vision and a willingness to invest in ourselves. So when you look at Wilson's growth trajectory and you look at what we were back in the 1980s, which was tobacco and textiles, and you look at where we are today, which is life sciences, aerospace, and automotive, it is due to that leadership and those investments. So from an infrastructure standpoint, we invested back in the 90s in a 50-year supply of water. So in trying to attract life sciences, that is one of the most critical things you have to be able to show a biopharma company, is that they've got water for the duration of the company. We also invested in waste treatment, one of the most critical issues that could stop growth in North Carolina today is the nitrogen levels, and the nitrogen levels that are imposed by Diener and how cities and counties can meet those levels. And I would bet that most legislators don't even know the impact, what the impact could be to your community, because it's just not something you think about every day, but it's something we work with economic development all the time. We invested in fiber in Wilson. We were the first city in North Carolina to have a gigabyte of fiber to every address in Wilson County. And we look at that as basic infrastructure. And finally, a couple of years ago, we started the Wilson Academy of Applied Technology, which is a very unique high school, early college program that is hands-on manufacturing-geared school, where there are four tracks that these kids can learn, pre-engineering, biotechnology, information technology, and mechatronics. And we have 50 slots a year, and the kids line up for those slots, and we interview them, and only the best are chosen. So in addition, while we were investing in the big community things that you need, our basic infrastructure to be able to grow our community, we were also investing in product. So we have a corporate park. We have a shell building fund. We just built a new corporate park. We're investing in our downtown, and right now we're working with a Tiger Grant on US 301 to revitalize 301. And if you've driven by Parker's Barbecue, you know why we need to revitalize. Our companies are a variety. We target life science, We target aerospace, we target automotive, food, packaging, and those jobs fit the skills in Wilson. We've got everything from the very low skilled to the very high skilled. And we're fortunate because, like Charlotte, we have in-migration of workers every day. So if you took my entire workforce in Wilson, it is almost the same as Raleigh's. 0.9 jobs for every two people. Theirs is one job for every two people, and in another year, I'll be at one job for every two people. And by having a variety of skills, we can put a good portion of the population within Wilson to work. So there are very, very high-end jobs, and then there are low-skilled jobs throughout these companies. When we compete all over the place. It can get a little confusing. We compete with Chicago and New York and Austin and Raleigh and Durham. And we also compete internationally, particularly with European facilities, Ireland, Southeast Asia, you know, a lot with Germany on various projects. And then for some projects, like the plastics projects, we might be competing with neighboring counties around our community. When we compete with Raleigh and Durham, we don't always lose, even though we're small, because we do have the infrastructure in place. People can commute into Wilson from a 30-mile radius, which allows people from Wake County and Cary and Durham to drive into Wilson every day to go to work. And we do have the Wilson Academy of Applied Technology. So we are investing in ourselves, and biopharma companies and aerospace companies can see that. A couple of recent wins that are a little bit different. Fresenius Kabi is a biopharma manufacturer. We worked with Chris Chung's outfit on this project. Even though it's an existing industry for us, they had a brand new plant that was looking worldwide. And the final competition came down to New York, Chicago, and Wilson, and we won. It's 445 jobs, which is fantastic, at an average salary of $50,000 a year and a $150 million investment. And why that's important for Wilson is we are as interested in seeing existing industry grow as we are in seeing new industry. So to be able to compete for a second plant from a great company that we know well and know their how they operate and how they invest and how they treat their people was just a really good win for us. At the same time, we had an issue with or an opportunity with Bridgestone, an opportunity to retain 2,200 jobs with a $360 million investment at an average salary of $60,000 a year. And this is something you guys are not set up, honestly, at the state level to deal with, because you don't do job retention. But I can tell you that if Bridgestone had closed, it would have knocked out a third of Wilson's workforce, a third. So we couldn't afford to let Wilson lose a Bridgestone. And one of the things I think that you as a legislative body need to look at is there are one or two catalyst companies in every single county in North Carolina. Who are those companies, and what do we need to do to make sure we keep them and grow them? My community has really high expectations. It's not just about keeping existing industry and adding new industries and jobs and investment. They look for me to bring in $1.50 to $1.80 for every dollar I am given. They look for me to stay focused on economic development and not get pulled into other areas where there are other entities doing those things. So I'm not the workforce guru. I'm the person who can go out and do a deal for you. The primary partners we work with are things you guys fund, EDPNC, the Department of Commerce. We work a lot with Golden Leaf, Dan Gerlach's group, We work with consultants and brokers across the country. So a big portion, about a third of the companies we see every year, come directly from industrial real estate agents or site location consultants. About a third come from EDPNC, and that's up from about 10% 4 years ago when that function was in the Department of Commerce. We work with our city and county. We work with the regional groups. We work with our neighbors, the community college, the biotech center. I'll work with anybody to do a deal. On the product side, we work with the Department of Commerce a lot, and the incentives that are out there, I know you have heard a lot about JDIG and smaller communities and CAPS and all of that. For us, we're more likely to use 1NC fund, we're more likely to use building reuse, and we are more likely to use the utility fund than a JDIG, because the traditional administrative cap for the number of jobs is about 100 jobs with a JDIG. And we are always looking for companies that are going to be very highly automated and may or may not have 100 employees. We also work with Golden Leaf, DOT, and my city and county are willing to invest. With EDP, we work on a lot of things. One of the things we do is we do marketing ventures with Chris Chung's group. And one of the things he has done so nicely is he has opened up the opportunity for every county at an affordable level to be able to do marketing trips with the EDPNC staff. So we will do anywhere from 2 to 4 marketing activities with EDPNC every year. We work with them on a lot of client visits. We work with them on existing industry calls. We work with them on existing industry clients who are looking at expansions, and they send us questionnaires on a weekly basis. On the Department of Commerce side, we're working more on incentives, infrastructure grants, or, you know, building reuse. But I have to tell you, the staff on both sides is very professional, work hard, are great to work with. I started thinking about what do we need? What do we as North Carolinians need? And what everyone needs everywhere is basic infrastructure for growth. Water, sewer, natural gas, electric, fiber, those basic things. If you don't have those things, you are not going to grow. We need to look at our sewer limits on things like the nitrogen level. Water, if a locality's not investing in water, where are they going to be in 10 years? We need well-connected transportation and an adequate supply of sites and buildings. And we need an educated workforce. But by county, that differs. So small counties may need something different from a medium-sized county or a large county. There's a lot of discussion about Charlotte and Raleigh and Greensboro and Winston, and should we take this away from them? You know, as a smaller county, I'm going to tell you honestly, no. A rising tide does lift all boats. Raleigh's growth helps Wilson, North Carolina, helps Nash County, helps Pitt County. So, no, we don't want you to stop incentives for the larger communities. But for the very smallest and the very poorest of communities, they need more help. They need more help than a medium-sized community like a Wilson. So you take a small, poor county, and they may need to have no cap on JDIG because they may need that kind of help. They may need help in figuring out long-term what kind of planned investments they should make in infrastructure because they may not have the expertise in their community. And we need to, just as a rising tide lifts all boats, a drain drains us all down. So we need to help the poorest and the smallest. And I appreciate you being willing to listen to me today.
Very good. Thank you, Jennifer. Questions for Jennifer?
Yes.
Representative Mueller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for a nice presentation, Ms. Lance, and your enthusiasm. I was interested in your comment about the Academy of Applied Technology. Lots of times we hear in various committees that we have jobs, but we don't have the people to fill the jobs. Now, in this program that you have with the Applied Technology Group, how many of those graduates are able to go directly into industry and jobs? And I imagine most of them will go on to university, but are any of them able to go directly into a job in industry?
This academy is only 2 years old, but it is run by a board of directors, which is my industrialists. So they help set the curriculum. All of these students will have an internship in an industry. So every student who chooses to can go to work directly out of once they get their associate's degree. And for most of those students, if they choose to get a college degree, my local industries will pay for it. So all of those students will be able to go directly to work, and they're learning very hands-on type things. So in English, instead of maybe having a paper on Shakespeare, they're going to have to read product manuals and write a paper on a technical report and things like that. They've learned a lot about OSHA. They know what programmable logical controls are. You know, they're learning very hands-on things that they can take directly into the workplace. And part of that is done at a high school campus, and part of it's done at our community college campus.
Sarah McKissick.
Yes, and this may be a question that is most appropriate either staff or maybe Chris Kyung, but I observed that you mentioned there are no funds available or no policies to help with employment retention. And I recall us specifically passing legislation in the past to assist firms. I recall one was down in Cumberland County, a tire manufacturer.
The JMAC.
Exactly. And I knew another one was down east. I thought it was actually...
In Wilson.
Exactly, in Wilson.
It is.
So that's why I was a bit confused, because I know we had done that. Granted, it hasn't been recently, but I'm wondering if there's been some shift in direction that means that there's a perception that we are not willing to take that on and do it again.
I think with JMAC, it's very specific. So while it may work for a Bridgestone or a Kelly Tire in Fayetteville, it's not going to help your Catalyst project in Charlotte or your Catalyst project in Rockingham County. There is not a specific incentive program to retain jobs, Catalyst jobs, across North Carolina. I think that's more what I meant. I wasn't specifically, you know, talking about JMAC.
Follow up. So what would you suggest that we might think about doing? Because I knew we had done that on those specific occasions. You know, you stay around here long enough, you have this archive in the back of your mind. So what would you suggest that we do differently that might, in fact, create the type of tool or resource that's needed in those specific situations that could apply statewide?
I would defer to Chris, but I suspect it's something similar to a JDIG or a JMAC, but it might be, very limited to what companies could apply for it. It might be shorter in duration than a JDIG would be. So you might not do it for a dozen years, but you might do it for five, that sort of thing.
Got it. Is that something Chris could address?
Chris, you want to try it now, or you want to think on that a little bit? Okay. Any other questions? Senator Smith.
Thank you, Chairman Brown. Director Lance, thank you so much for your comprehensive presentation. I did have a quick question in terms of your staff. Did you have, like, Charlotte had two full-time economic developers? How many economic developers did your council have?
We have a 3.5 person staff in Wilson, and we're just the Economic Development Council, so we're not part of a chamber. We are publicly funded, and in addition to doing the marketing function for Wilson. We are also a nonprofit development corporation, so we do all of the development as well. We build industrial parks. We do all the infrastructure projects. We build shell buildings, and we handle unique real estate deals for the city and county.
Real quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. So I'd be interested, maybe this is something we can take offline, but in terms of some of your recommendations, I was interested in the planned investment because it seems like definitely you carved out a niche in terms of the industry perspectives that you wanted to analyze and bring to a Wilson County. So if that's some opportunity down the road, I'd be very much interested in that. For some of the smaller counties, not medium-sized, who don't have full-time economic developers. And Mr. Chair, just a follow-up to Senator McKissick, last month we received a presentation that gave the analysis of all the projects funded between 2003 and 2007, and as I recall, there was only one JMAC that was funded, and that was, I believe, in Rutherford County.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right on that. Any other questions? All right, got Representative Martin.
Thank you. Thank you for coming, and thank you all for listening to my good friend Jennifer, who we have the privilege of working together in Wilson, and she's been a great help in any of my questions on the ground. One of the things that we've discussed earlier was how the collaboration is working with the Partnership in Commerce, and we've been struggling to make sure that the projects are getting pushed out as much as possible around the state and not just fishing in a barrel, not just landing where someone calls and says, oh yeah, Raleigh. And we want to see more activity. And you had shared some things that were going on about partners getting out in the community and getting dispersed and getting to know what the state is. Can you share a little bit about that experience? Because I think that would be of interest to members.
Absolutely. The EDPNC makes the effort every year to, by Prosperity Zone, meet with all of the economic development folks in each of the Prosperity Zones. And they meet at different places within the Prosperity Zone each year. So for the past 3 years, for example, we're part of the North Central Prosperity Zone. We've met in Raleigh, Durham, and this year in Wilson. And it gives the economic developers an opportunity to talk about what's going on in their community, particularly from a product standpoint. And it gives EDPNC representatives the opportunity to talk to the local economic developers about what kinds of projects are out there looking. And, you know, I can tell you, I see, you know, a third of my clients are coming from EDPNC, and that was not happening 5 years ago. That is huge for us. And like Chris said, we see a ton of foreign direct investment projects right now. And I think my number, if you ask me 2 years from now, would probably be EDPNC is bringing us about half our clients. So I think they're doing a great job of pushing projects out to anyone who has product, but you have to have the product, a building or a site or a corporate park. And if you don't have those things, then you as a community have got to invest in yourself, because this, you know, you've got to do it or you're not going to see economic growth.
All right. Thank you so much, Jennifer. Good job. All right, next we have from the North Carolina Rural Center, Patrick Woody, president. Patrick, thanks for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair. We greatly appreciate the opportunity to be with you today and to present. I'd like to begin by recognizing a couple of our board members that have been able to attend today. Jennifer Tolley Whiteside, who is President and CEO of the North Carolina Community Foundation, and also Debbie Hamrick, who is Specialty Crops Director for the North Carolina Farm Bureau Federation. Appreciate them being here. I'd also like to recognize John Coggin, our Director of Advocacy at the Rural Center. And one final shout out to Rex Foster, one of your house sergeants in arms, who is a member of our Rural Economic Development Institute, class number 28. He's a great volunteer in his part of Northwestern Franklin County, and we're very honored to have him as part of our institute this year. Since 1987, the Rural Center has worked to improve the quality of life for the state's rural people and communities. We recognize the changing landscape of rural North Carolina brings significant challenges, but we believe in the resiliency of our state's rural people and their dedicated stewardship of their communities. The Center's mission is to develop, promote, and implement sound economic strategies that improves the quality of life of rural people in rural places. We serve the state's 80 rural counties with a special focus on individuals with low to moderate incomes and communities with limited resources. As we begin our fourth decade at the center, we focus our programmatic work in leadership, engagement, lending, and research. It'd be hard to exaggerate just how much the state has changed during the 30 years the center has been in existence. Today, there aren't many issues that get more attention or more ink than the rural-urban divide. We prefer to focus our attention and our effort on fostering better connections between and better understanding between our rural and urban communities. The demographic profile of North Carolina has also changed drastically over 30 years, yet North Carolina remains deeply rooted in a culture of rural life. Rebecca Tippett, Director of Carolina Demography at the Carolina Population Center at UNC Chapel Hill, often refers to North Carolina's, quote, persistent rurality. Consider this. North Carolina has the second largest rural population behind only Texas. North Carolina also has the second highest number of small towns, second only to Pennsylvania. Our rural population is more dense than many of our counterpart states. Our urban population is more dispersed than counterpart states, putting more of our rural areas in closer proximity and economic orbit to our metropolitan areas. A map of commuting patterns drives home an important point about North Carolina. It is too easy to get distracted about the divide and lose sight of the vast economic and social connections that bind our rural communities, small towns, suburban neighborhoods, and urban cores into a patchwork of economic interdependency. Senator Smith and I had the opportunity to participate last week in a community forum sponsored by the NNO that focused at the Museum of History that focused on bridging the divide between our urban and rural areas. More than 200 mostly Raleigh citizens signed up for the event. Here's what I believe. Stronger connections will only be achieved through very intentional and deliberate work at the state, regional, and local levels. As John Hood said in an op-ed this week, building bridges is hard, patient work. No one ever crossed a river by yelling at the far bank until it gave in. The fact we are interdependent and connected, from sharing workforce to healthcare delivery systems, to the food we grow and eat, to manufacturing and other economic sectors, to education, water, and natural resources, for North Carolina to grow and prosper, all of North Carolina must grow and foster. When we opened our doors in 1987, North Carolina was at the top of the list of states with the highest percentage of native-born population. That reality has changed as more and more individuals have called North Carolina home and come to this state looking for good jobs or a better quality of life. That's a great compliment. And whether they move to our rural, suburban, or urban areas, our state's historic city cousin, country cousin connections are diminishing. Before we talk about rural North Carolina, we must define what exactly we consider rural in the state. At the center, we identify 80 of the state's 100 counties as rural, determined by population density. These 80 counties all have less than 250 people per square mile. The 14 blue counties have more than 250, but less than 500 per square mile. And those six core urban counties all have population densities far greater than 750. The map you see here will change in 2020 when the final census numbers are in. We believe that density of population is the single most defining characteristic of what makes a rural place a rural place. Ours is only one definition among many. It's not the right one. It's just one definition that we consistently used over 30 years. One thing that causes us concern at the Rural Center are the places in state economic development legislation where a rural county is defined as, quote, any Tier 1 or Tier 2 county. That produces some absurd results. For example, Forsyth, Guilford, and Cumberland are all rural, counties under that definition. The USDA Rural Development Office, whose programs collectively put $1.7 billion in grants and loans into North Carolina's rural communities in 2017, now has a different definition of rural for almost every program it operates. So it's challenging. The Rural Division of Commerce can make grants, by our count, into 92 of the state's 100 counties. We need to address the future use of the tier system that you've worked hard on, but even more than that, we must target state support for struggling counties. The 80 Tier 1 and Tier 2 counties are not all distressed counties. All of North Carolina's 80 rural counties are not distressed counties, but I submit to you that there are roughly 20 to 25, all of them rural, that are in chronic distress, and we need to focus more attention and more urgency on them, and it will not be easy work. We worry that funding with the stated intention of focusing on rural economic development is actually being diluted as it is distributed into counties misclassified as rural. Our chronically distressed rural counties face capacity limitations that inhibit their very ability to even apply for programmatic funding. You're going to be hearing from the state demographer, so I'm not going to dwell on the data in this presentation, but I urge you to take a look at the data points we share because we believe they tell a significant and a not well understood story about change in average employment and taxable wages over the last decade, about alarmingly elevated poverty rates that point to stark contrasts of race and equity within rural and between rural, suburban, and urban. These next three maps illustrate population change, county health rankings, and post-secondary educational attainment. The redder you are, the less well you're doing. Notice the clustering of the same counties that occurs across these three slides. Regardless of metric, they illustrate those 20 to 25 chronically distressed rural counties, particularly regions in the Northeast, Southeast Sandhills, and a few in the West. County health rankings, post-secondary attainment, education attainment. When you've seen one rural county, well, you've seen one rural county. That is why in April of 2017, we launched our rural road trip, an effort to spend intentional time in all 80 of the counties we serve to understand the nuance and diversity that exists across the rural parts of our state. As of today, we have visited 76 counties with four to go. Just this week, we've been to Stokes, Caswell, Harnett, and Johnston counties, a vivid illustration of the spectrum of rural county realities out there across our state. These visits have put us in conversation with the grasstop leadership in each county. We've heard firsthand about the issues facing them that keep them up at night. But we also get to hear about what's working, the opportunities. In a general sense, we have found hopeful, optimistic leaders with a vision for deep roots in, and sober realism about the opportunities and the challenges that they face. They recognize a couple of truths. One, there is no single silver bullet. And two, the cavalry isn't coming. They know the cavalry is already sitting there around the table. They know change takes long-term planning, dedication, a willingness to invest in themselves, and hard work. And nobody cares more about their community than they do. What they want from the state and federal government is partnership, a dedication to removing roadblocks instead of erecting new ones, and a recognition that rural economic development is not the same as urban economic development, nor should it be. Senator Brown will recognize the location of this photo. Our biggest turnout in any county was the 50 rural leaders that joined us at the library of Jones County Senior High School. It remains one of our most memorable and moving visits. More specifically, what we have found on the positive side of the ledger as we've moved around the state. near universal success in all places with early college and dual enrollment in local K-12 systems. Marked improvements in collaboration between K-12, community college, and university systems. Small regional examples of communities that are closing the rural broadband gap through a mix of technologies, a range of public-private partnerships, and small and nimble internet service providers. Half of our 80 rural counties are seeing a net increase in 31 to 40-year-olds who are ready to put down roots and raise families. A surge in food-based businesses, from sustainable farms to agritourism to value-added food manufacturing, often run by millennial entrepreneurs, and broad understanding of the need for regional solutions to shared challenges. On the negative side of the ledger, we found the opioid drug crisis affects every place we visited and is a major barrier to growing the adult workforce. The rural health system is strained by the volume of uncompensated care and a mental health system that isn't functioning well virtually anywhere we've been. A severe shortage of workforce housing in the $125,000 to $250,000 range, and water and sewer infrastructure that is in desperate need of modernization and maintenance. When we look at the opportunities and challenges we're seeing from the road trip, several economic development priorities emerge. This spring, we'll be analyzing what we've heard on the ground and compiling best practices, lessons learned, and policy recommendations. We'll be sharing those in detail at Rural Day on May 29th. In the meantime, we would like to pose major questions we are studying and that we hope you will also consider. While some places have ready-to-go sites and buildings, many do not. More rural product is essential. What is the state's role in helping to develop that local product? We need to build the organizational capacity of local EDOs, economic development organizations. The reality is that the only way to do that in some areas may be through regional collaboration. Is the state willing to play a role in building that organizational capacity? There are organic regional economic development efforts taking place on the ground. Mountain West Partnership is a great example in the far southwest. How can the state help incent those inherently valuable efforts? And finally, rural community colleges are perhaps the most important and undervalued and underappreciated high-capacity rural anchor institution and are potentially position to play a greater role in local regional economic development efforts. We've seen examples of this at Tri-County, Wilkes, Surrey, and Piedmont Community Colleges, just to name a few. How can we elevate the ability of our rural community colleges to forge innovative regional solutions to our most pressing rural problems? It's important that North Carolina better understand how communities sit in larger regional economies. It is easy for rural places to get lost in the granular needs facing particular communities, but focusing only on those issues to the detriment of larger regional perspective and losing sight of economic drivers and trends that cross county lines will inhibit larger regional partnerships that can benefit everyone. That is why, in partnership with Golden Leaf Foundation and the Friday Institute, the Rural Center recently launched a new initiative working with the 17 counties that make up our Northeast Prosperity Zone. The initiative aims to broaden regional leadership capacity and to build cross-cutting partnership to identify regional assets and needs and to develop innovative regional projects to promote economic growth. So what is our perspective of our rural capacity for economic development across rural North Carolina? We see enormous variation in the capacities of local EDOs. This is largely a function of geography, with metro adjacent and high amenity rural counties having greater organizational capacity and greater success than the more isolated rural counties. We see there is a need for a baseline understanding of what our local EDO capacity really is. That means a statewide inventory of local and regional economic development organizations throughout the state, and we think that might be beneficial to rural and urban alike. We see that high-capacity rural counties have more than one full-time staff member and frequently have an existing industry director on staff, but there are still too few of them. Staff capacity focused exclusively on startups and entrepreneurs is a rare thing. Several counties have no dedicated full-time economic development staff. What are the existing resources in the state that we can build upon and expand? The EDPNC, which has an excellent staff and is well known and greatly appreciated by our local leadership, is significantly under-resourced, particularly with respect to best serving our existing businesses. There are 75 to 80 statewide regional organizations, including the Rural Center, focused on providing resources and technical assistance to North Carolina's small businesses, but they are not effectively coordinated from a state perspective. And we know how to do this, but we only do it in the aftermath of an economic recession or a natural disaster, and then we don't do it for long at a time. In regards to prosperity zones, beyond our regional commerce planners, many of whom joined us for our county visits and identified projects as a result of some of our visits, there is limited and inconsistent regional capacity at the prosperity zone level. Our state RPOs, transportation organizations, are challenged by lack of technical and financial resources to advance rural transportation priorities further and faster. RPOs are seriously outgunned by far better resourced MPOs. Our Council of Government relationships are strong and trusted by local governments across many of our most rural regions. These regional relationships are the longest and deepest in the state, dating back to the 1960s. They are addressing the needs of the region. Comprehensive economic development strategies, broadband demand aggregation studies, broadband vertical asset inventories, just to name a few. But the COGS are also seriously resource challenged. Again and again throughout our travels and in our conversations during our road trip, three top issues consistently stood out to us that cut across the rural communities, all of the rural communities that we have visited. They are rural broadband. While it is difficult to get an exact count, too much of rural North Carolina is cut off from adequate, accessible, truly high-speed internet. It is the rural infrastructure imperative of our time. Lack of broadband access prohibits regional progress in healthcare delivery, education and workforce training delivery, business recruitment, business retention, and entrepreneurship. It requires a comprehensive and bold state-based solution that addresses priorities of access, affordability, and adoption, that supports all viable last-mile technology solutions and not only one, that supports public-private partnerships to serve unserved and underserved areas, that clarifies the appropriate roles local governments can play in meeting the broadband needs of their citizens. The Joint Committee on Access to Healthcare in Rural North Carolina, co-chaired by Senator Curtis and Representative Lewis, is focused on this issue of health. So I won't say much about it here, but you can't talk about the state of rural economic development without talking about rural health as an economic sector. In rural North Carolina, that sector accounts for more than 179,000 jobs and more than $2 billion in taxable wages. The foundation of any healthy economy is a healthy workforce, and rural health care providers are struggling under the weight of too much uncompensated care, closing the coverage gap, connecting more working families to accessible and affordable health care is a moral and an economic imperative for our state. This is Darlene Brown. More than 15 years ago, she received a microloan from the Rural Center to start her own small business in Kinston. Today, Brown Sweet Treats is still up and running, baking delicious cakes. The Rural Center's microloan program helped Darlene develop a business plan get the capital she needed to turn a hobby into a successful career. There is real opportunity to grow our existing businesses and nurture our startup entrepreneurs in rural communities. The definition of entrepreneurship really matters here. To us, it includes four classic types of businesses: microenterprise, Main Street, second stage, and innovation led. And all of them matter. Too often when we talk about entrepreneurship, we're, a lot of people are only using that word to refer to the innovation led startups. Our state's lead recruiter, who you've heard from today and you heard from last time, made a powerful case at the last meeting that it is exactly the right case in our opinion. Recruitment is a vital component of our state's economic development plan, but it is only one leg of a three-legged stool. Economic development and job creation is not just about recruitment. We must not let our statewide conversation stop with Amazon and Toyota Mazda. It is critical that we also pay attention to our state's existing businesses and entrepreneurs. They should be equally strong legs of the stool, every bit as strong as our recruitment leg, and right now that is not the case. The state should make it their top economic development priority to focus attention and resources on bringing a high level of coordination to statewide systems that support our existing businesses and entrepreneurs. In closing, talk about the rural-urban divide expresses itself particularly strongly in conversations about economic development. I'm here to tell you that we don't have to pit rural versus urban in order to succeed. The landscape looks different in rural and urban settings, but the solutions for economic development in those different landscapes are not at odds, and it need not be a zero-sum game. The Rural Center is ready to work with the members of this committee and economic developers across the state to find ways to grow all of our economies and to help rural and urban North Carolina succeed together. Because if we don't succeed as a state, we won't succeed. As one upcoming opportunity to work together, the Rural Center will be hosting our second annual Rural Day on May 29th at the Museum of History. Last year, 300 rural leaders from 70 rural counties joined us to discuss the successes and challenges in their communities and to visit with their elected officials. This year, the Rural Center will make a major announcement around our commitment to support our state's rural small business owners and entrepreneurs. We hope you'll be there with us to hear directly from the men and women who call rural North Carolina home, and to celebrate the many voices and viewpoints that make this state such a great place to live. I want to thank you for your time and for inviting us here today to speak on this vital issue to our state.
Thank you, Patrick. Good report. I want to thank you for taking the time to visit all those counties. I can imagine they're all unique in their own way and have different challenges. And just getting out and talking to those people, I'm sure was enlightening and probably humbled you in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. Yeah. One of the best things I ever did.
Yep. Real quick, because we got to move this, but any questions for Patrick at this point? Real quick, if you would, Senator McKissick.
Sure. I've heard a lot of potential solutions to this connectivity for broadband in rural areas, but what are your thoughts about the most effective way of doing it since you've had extended dialogue and communications?
I think there's a broad understanding in this body across all kinds of ways of cutting this body that it is really an important, it is the rural issue of the day. I think one of the struggles we've had is really gaining consensus around what is the right approach to solving the problem. As we've talked to virtually everybody that operates and has a role to play in solving the rural broadband issue, what's needed is a really comprehensive solution. It's not a single thing that's going to solve the problem. It's going to take a combination of things. And there are rural parts of this state that are very well served by broadband, but they are too far and too few between. In general, those areas that are best served are served by rural telephone cooperatives that have adopted the electric co-op model have been able to do some things that their for-profit counterparts have not been able to do. We are seeing other states around the country that are addressing the issue by creating a state grants program. They're very similar. They're agnostic about the technological solutions, so they're supporting a mix of technologies. They're allowing any ISP, internet service provider, to be eligible for the funding and to compete for that funding. And they're letting the grant dollars go to the areas that are only underserved or unserved, and that is carefully defined. And they're making real headway. Minnesota's example, Ohio is right kind of where you are, maybe a little ahead of North Carolina. They're getting ready. One of the House of Representatives in Ohio is getting ready to vote on a state grants program. We'll see how that goes. But we think it takes a combination of things. And on the private sector side, what nonprofits and all of us can do without government resources is really work on adoption. Because once we have it, if we don't use it, that's an issue. We've got to work on affordability. We've got to work on solving the homework gap. Those students that are, even in some of our poorest counties, are getting the handheld devices and Chromebooks that they can't take home and use, either because there's no access at all or they can't afford the access. And those are things we can all work to address.
Mr. Chair, I just had a quick question for clarification.
Real quick.
Slide 11, could you clarify for me, in terms of post-secondary education, is that with degree attainment? Because those percentages seem awfully high. Or is that just some studies?
Either degree or some certification attainment.
So at minimum an associate's degree.
Yeah. It could be a certificate. An industry certificate, but beyond high school diploma.
All right, Patrick, thanks a lot. Great presentation. Next, we've got a presentation on the demographic trends in North Carolina. We've got Michael Klein, the state demographer, who will give us a presentation. So, Michael.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chairwoman. Thank you, members of the committee, for inviting me here today. This is almost exactly 1 year since I've moved here from Texas, so I'm one of those migrants to North Carolina, and I've enjoyed it so far. I have a lot to cover, and I could probably spend a whole afternoon talking to you about the demographic trends occurring in North Carolina, but I want to hit some highlights and talk about how those may challenge economic development as for the state as a whole, as well as different areas of the state. Now, many of y'all already know, but it's great to point out that Villanova is not the only group that beat Michigan. North Carolina, during this present decade, has become the ninth largest state in the country. Since 2010, we added about 737,000 people. That's more than the states of New York, Pennsylvania, and Ohio. Now, if we look back almost exactly 48 years ago, the 1970 census was being conducted. And at that point in time, North Carolina, the number of people was at 5.1 million. Over the next 48 years, our state more than doubled. And if these trends continue, we expect that by 2020, our population will be 10.6 million. In the next 20 years to 2037, we expect our population to be 12.6 million in the state. So the good news is our state is growing. The challenge is that if we expect our growth to be what it was in the last two decades, well, that's not happening. The next few decades, our rate of growth is much slower, and there's a lot of different reasons for that. Even though we're adding each decade 1 million, 1 million each decade. But that's not the same number of people that grew in the last two decades. We added about almost 1.5 in the 1990s and then 2000s. Our rate of growth we project for this decade will be about 11.4%. That's slower than the 1960s and one of the slower decades over since we became a state. Now, as we know, our growth is not equally distributed. Our population is not equally distributed. Most of our growth is occurring in the major urban areas, particularly in that urban crescent, the Raleigh-Durham Triangle, down to Charlotte, as well as the Wilmington area. And most of our losses are particularly in the eastern part of North Carolina and in rural areas in particular. Between 2010 and 2016, our latest certified population estimates for the state of North Carolina, there were 23 counties growing faster than the state as a whole, and 35 counties that lost population. Just give you a comparison, last decade there were 6 counties that lost population. We project that these trends continue. In the next 10 years, there will be 29 counties losing population, again, primarily in that northeast, down in the southeast, and some other rural areas scattered throughout the state. And areas of the highest growth, those areas in the dark green, again, in that urban crescent area, Wilmington, out in Asheville, and parts in the Mountain West. Now, when people talk to me about population change, often they're wondering how many people are moving to the state. And the reality is our population grows in two different ways. One is natural increase, more people being born than dying, and the other is net migration, more people moving in than moving out. If we look back into the 1950s and 1960s, all of our growth was from natural increase, because there were more people leaving the state than coming in. By the 1970s, that began to change. And in the 1990s, 2000 and 2010, about over 60% of our growth was from net in-migration as opposed to natural increase. Now, if we just focus on net migration specifically, in comparison to our neighboring states, we have more people moving in than leaving, and we have a good balance of 3/4 of that is people moving from other states into North Carolina than leaving, and about 1/4 from international. That compares to Virginia, where all of their net migration is due to international migration because there are more people leaving the state than coming in. Now I want to focus specifically on domestic migration. The interesting fact about domestic migration as we compare to other states, we're only one of 23 states, including the District of Columbia, where there's more people moving into the state than are leaving. And we're actually number 3 after Florida and Texas. I just want to give you a perspective of how our migration, this is just looking at migration rates specifically for different areas of North Carolina, specifically as it relates to the previous downturn in our economy. That downturn impacted net migration nationwide. More people were, because there were not jobs available, people were reluctant to move. So that impacted net migration. It also impacted birth rates. So we saw birth rates go down significantly, particularly among Hispanics. But looking at net migration specifically, we're seeing an uptick in net migration in the different regions of the state, but still not to that level that we saw prior to the recession. Now, in addition to the challenge of a slower growth in our population, we're seeing an aging of our population. The baby boom generation is already moving in to the older ages, 65 years and older. And by 2030, the U.S. Census Bureau projects that one in five adults will be 65 years and older. One in five people will be 65 years and older. And that's the same for North Carolina. In the next several years, on an annual basis, 60,000 people will be moving into that age 65 years and older. And between now and 2037, we expect to add over 1 million people in that age group. Now, wanted to look at another age group, the 25 to 54. Just pick this because, you know, this is a prime working age group, even though people may start working at an earlier age or continue to work even beyond age 65. But to give you a perspective of the changing age structure of our population, we'll still see growth in this age group on an annual basis, but not near what we're seeing age 65 and older. And we'll see an addition of about 700,000 between now and 2037. Finally, as we look at the changing, in addition to aging, changes in the aging structure of our population, we're becoming more racially and ethnically diverse. I think some previous speakers talked about that change in diversity. Nationally, U.S. projections show that by 2043, there'll be no majority population, racial or ethnic group. And in North Carolina, our projections do not go beyond 2037 at this time. But by 2037, we expect that 58% of our population will be non-Hispanic white. Another 29% or 22% African American, about 14% Hispanic, and growth in the Asian American group as well. Now, one of the challenges with this changing diversity is if we do not close those educational gaps in those groups. To give you a perspective, those educational gaps also have impacts on our median household incomes, not only for those different groups, but also in the aggregate. African Americans, American Indians, and Hispanic household incomes are about 60% of that of non-Hispanic whites. And so if that population is growing in the future and we don't close those gaps, then the income in the state of North Carolina is likely to go down. Finally, I just want to say, take a brief moment and talk about the 2020 census and the impacts for North Carolina. In addition to the use of census data, census data is not only is important both for businesses, nonprofits, as well as the state government. $16.3 billion are distributed to North Carolina, either directly or indirectly, based on Census Bureau numbers. The estimates that I produce on an annual basis are important to distribution to local communities and counties, and those account for about $1.5 billion on an annual basis, about $200 per capita. And that's actually, that doesn't include some other items that are population estimates are used for. So as we get ready for the 2020 census, it'll be critical to make sure that everyone is counted in North Carolina for the state and for the different communities in North Carolina. And with that, I'll close and entertain any questions.
Thank you, Michael. talking about that subject now, the military, how it will be counted, have you got that ruling on how it'll be counted? Can you talk about that real quick?
Yes, sir. Okay, so one of the things we actually, the census, so the estimate numbers that I showed are our estimates. These are the state estimates that we produce, and I'll get to this as well. There were some recent estimates that came out about a week or two ago from the Census Bureau. We work closely with the Census Bureau, but they use different estimates, or they use different methods to estimate the population. One of the things that has been challenging for Onslow County and Cumberland County in particular is that in 2010, there were many troops that were temporarily assigned in Haiti, and so they were not counted in North Carolina. Now, for the estimates, I worked closely with the Census Bureau to make sure on the estimates we at least account for a portion of that population that wasn't counted. Those are the troops that were in military quarters, and with these current estimates that just came out, that has been the case, and we expect that to be showing up in the place estimates the Census Bureau will produce in May. Now, specifically to your question for Census 2020, Bob Coates, my colleague, has worked closely with the Census Bureau and kind of and the Military Affairs Committee to make sure that coming to 2020, that those, if that same thing happens, that we are counting those individuals in North Carolina and local communities, and that has been passed, or they have determined that that will be the way they count 2020.
So that make a big difference in our communities.
It should, particularly in those military communities.
Yeah. All right, any other questions for Michael? All right, as everybody can see, it's a changing state, that's for sure. All right, Michael, thanks a lot. Good report.
Thank you.
With that, I think that takes care of our business, unless there's any other comments. Yeah. We may meet on the 15th. I know everybody is coming back on that day, I think, to start session. So we're looking at a possible meeting on the 15th. We'll let you know if we can get that worked out, but that's a date we're throwing around sometime that day. Sir McKissick?
This is just one quick question that has been in the back of my mind. I noticed that in one of these reports we talked about export revenues increasing last year from $832,000 up to $890 million, and which is pretty substantial, pretty impressive. But I'm also wondering in the back of my mind with, you know, the tariffs that have been announced recently and how that can impact tobacco and pork and all those other sectors of our economy. If there's somebody on the staff or with the P3, anybody who can shed some light in terms of what strategies might be in mind for dealing with the tariffs, proposed tariffs.
Chris, that's probably something you may have to look at. One of those probably don't know the answer yet, but I'm sure we'll be looking at what it may, if anything, affect.
I'd certainly like to hear about it from somebody in the near term, and certainly if we're going to come back on the 15th, I think it'd be great to have somebody at least provide us with a glimpse into what that might likely mean in terms of impacting our economy, since it's it could have some significant implications.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? All right. If not, we're adjourned.